the way, I did not come up with me as Batman and Nick Fuentes as Robin, as if I'm the boss. The crew did that. It's absolutely ridiculous. More like I'm George Washington and he's Andrew Jackson. It's a generational thing. And Nick is having a generational run. It's true. I met Nick over 9-10 years ago. Thought he was very intelligent, very smart. Wasn't as, quote, radical as he is now. And his story, you know, is now well known, the origin story, the rest of it. But as I've said a million times, I got attacked for having him on. The left, the Democrats, the ADL, all of them literally say Christians, Catholics, white people are the devil. We need to be eradicated. Even Elon Musk posted a video the other day showing hundreds of headlines saying abolish whites, we're the devil, we're the demon. So you can't point your finger at a Nick Fuentes who doesn't want to kill all the other groups, who doesn't want to do it, but says we're not going to put up with this anymore, and then say he's a Nazi. From a race-based position, the left is even more Nazi than Adolf Hitler. So I don't apologize for having Nick on, and I love the Streisand effect of getting him on Tucker. I, behind the scenes, engineered that, and I had no idea it would create an even bigger controversy. But here we are. So the time we have, the next hour and 50 minutes, I want to go through a lot of topics. We've got callers that are here, get some of them. A lot of people on X had questions. But Nick, first off, just paradoxically great to have you here. People can find all your work at Nick J. Fuentes on Rumble and find you on X. Big picture, answer this for me. Because they can take clips out of context. When Trump's doing something good, I see you promote it. When he does something bad, you put pressure on him. But paradoxically, my listeners just want to complain about Trump all day, which is fine. We take their calls, we do it. But how much time should be spent on the Democrats, BlackRock, the globalists, Islam? Because I also get this thing, whenever I cover something with Islam or China or anything, it's like, why aren't you exposing Israel? It's great to expose Israel. It's great that that taboo is over. The spell is broken, but then now as we enter this new era of where we're not just exposing a foreign controlling influence, how do we then promote a new system, and then what does that stand for? What is America first? That's a big question, but I'm sure you can answer it.
It is a good question, and I get asked this question a lot because I spend all my time attacking Republicans and the right wing, and Trump in particular, and people say, well, why don't you focus more on the left, or why don't you focus exclusively on the left? And to that, I would say we're in power right now. We, the Republicans, the Trump movement, are in power. Trump is in the White House. Republicans still, as of right now, control the House and the Senate. Allegedly, in the first term, they engineered it so that we could control the federal judiciary, the Supreme Court. So without a doubt, we have all the cards. We have all the power. And I think that when that is the case, especially, maybe it's a different story when Biden was in charge. I was certainly far more critical of the Democrats when he was the president. But when Republicans are in charge, I really believe we have a special obligation to put the heat on Trump and to light a fire under them to get the things that they promised to do finished, because we don't have that much time. And I understand what you're saying. There are some people that are telling us that, you know, politics is useless. It's a waste of time. People say things like there are no political solutions. And I, like you, am a bit more optimistic. I think that even the Trump administration presents us with opportunities. And as you said, when he does positive things, I heap praise upon Trump. Like, for example, for the tariffs, for securing the border. These are very positive things. We have to be honest, though, and say there are a lot of negatives here. For example, the foreign policy. This intervention in Venezuela has like a 16% approval rating with the voters. And it looks inevitable at this point. The Epstein files was a totally self-induced debacle. And so I do just think we have an obligation. There's a commission on the part of the America First base to be very loud. And I also think very negative. I think that we always have to be asking for more because time is of the essence. There's so much urgency. We don't realistically even have 4 years. We actually have like a year and a half. If we could talk about the timeline of the 4 years, breaking it down.
Yeah, let's do that. And I don't disagree with you. I think putting pressure on Trump is good. I was just putting the question out there. But let's talk about the timeline, sure. Big picture.
Yeah, so in terms of timeline, I was saying this throughout the election last year and even at the beginning of this year, and you know this perfectly well because you were around for the first term too, and we both watched it sort of in real time. Everybody thinks you get 4 years. That's the president's term. So people think we got 2025 until 2029 when the next president's inaugurated. And so we have plenty of time. And we really don't, though, because as you know, the ruling party almost always suffers in the midterms, especially in the House. It's almost a given that we will lose the House of Representatives in 2026. That is a year away. That more likely than not, because we have such a slim majority, we're going to lose the House. And you know that once we lose the House, the Democrats are going to do everything in their power to subpoena, to investigate. They're going to try and jam up the administration. It's going to take a lot of energy away from some of the other initiatives and projects. So that's a major pressure. The other thing is the elections. Probably before we even lose the House, there's going to be, to some extent, some moderating. The administration might not want to be extremely aggressive. They're going to be more risk averse because in the buildup to the midterms, they're going to be campaigning and they're going to try to win over people in the middle, the independents. We have to win the election. So realistically, in like the spring or the summer of next year, they might start to moderate. And then the third thing is that Trump is a lame duck. And that means that he is term limited. He can't run again in 2028. Starting in 2027, just a couple months after the midterms, like half his cabinet and many of the senators and governors might start their exploratory committees and start thinking about running for president. And that includes Vance, Rubio, Noem, DeSantis. Like a lot of people are going to start to look for the exits and they're going to have 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And so by 2027, there's not going to be a ton of focus. Then 28, you got another election. So all this is to say, you really need to push hard and strong and fast. There's a lot of urgency.
So what does Trump need to do right now? I mean, if you were the president, what would you do?
If I'm the president, I'm going to do mass deportations. I'm going to do everything in my power to deport as many people as possible immediately. And no excuses about we need to spin up the personnel. And I get it. I talk to people that are in government and I understand some of the problems, but we need like a Herculean effort to get those deportations up immediately.
Did you like Trump saying that he's going to total ban on all third world immigration?
I thought it was the best statement he's had in probably 5 years, but it's just a statement. We need to, if he turned that into policy, I'd be happy as a clam and I would be, you know, MAGA night at the White House. It would be 2016 all over again. We're never coming down. But the problem is we always just get these like statements. Trump gets in trouble in the polls. He gets in trouble with his favorability. And then we always see that he brings out the red meat and he throws this out to the base. And it's sort of disturbing that he knows exactly what to say. Like that was a perfect statement that I would love. And so you say to yourself, oh, so you do know how to make us happy. You know exactly what we want to hear. You know exactly what we want you to do. Why are we now getting it all of a sudden? Like you flipped a switch. We should have been getting this the entire time and not just in words, but in actions also. So yeah, I mean, I thought it was an excellent statement, but we just need to see it actualized and realized. It's too much talk. And it also just seems like he's covering his behind because we know that the numbers are really bad right now. Favorability, polling, approval, and even this generic ballot polling that's coming out for 26. Everybody knows, and you and I have been talking about it for months, he's in real trouble. Like Marjorie Greene resigning, they might lose their majority even before the midterms if they lose a couple more people, if a couple more people jump ship or drop out. And so I think
he puts a statement. And all he had to do was be nice to her and not attack her. It's another self-inflicted wound.
Exactly. And that's really the saddest thing about this is it's a missed opportunity. Here we are. We're well positioned. We know what we need to do. We know what the people want. We have the power to do it. He has the mandate. The left is disorganized. And yet it's all these self-inflicted wounds. And there was so much optimism and confidence, the golden age and all this kind of stuff. And it feels like all over again, we're squandering it. And you have to lay the blame at the feet of the people with responsibility. They're looting. And I'm sure you know about this too. It is like a criminal enterprise, the way the people in this government are looting the government. It is like the epitome of Grifter City, and everybody knows them there. It's insane. And, you know, so people don't see the change happening and they want to make excuses and talk about QAnon and five-dimensional chess.
And that's why they kicked Elon out, because he was doing real change.
Exactly right. Well, because he came in with private sector people and he said, we're going to move fast and break things. And, you know, we're going to have a technological solution to a political problem.
Because the system will collapse and none of the money's worth a thing. He didn't do it out of some altruism, but saving the ship. And these crazies are just continuing on with all of the, I mean, we can go into a deep dive on it, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, you're totally right. And it is. The whole country's collapsing and it feels like nothing is going to shake us out of this. Might have to get worse before it gets better. I'm not an accelerationist, but you almost feel that's inevitable because here we are. Things could not be worse in terms of the situation on the war footing, the fiscal situation, the debt situation, plus the mass migration. Like, how could it get worse? And yet we're still asleep
at
the
wheel.
So
let's look at a few scenarios. Crystal ball here. We're not saying this is the future, but particular futures. What are the futures you see if this doesn't succeed and the left comes in? Because people are radicalized. They're going to be, you know, Nick Fuentes or they're going to be Mondami. They're going to go America first. They're going to go commie. People, I mean, that shows how desperate the young people are.
Yeah, it's true. And especially in New York, where people that make six figures, they're affected by the affordability crisis. Like, New York is unaffordable for people that are actually making quite a bit of money. And what happens when people can't get ahead is they turn to that. When people have no stake in the society, they're going to turn to the redistribution, the redistributive scheme. And unfortunately, that comes with a lot of like anti-white grievance politics. And so I think what you're going to get in 28, I don't think it's so clean on the left because, you know, look, they've had the same problem for many, many years, which is there's a deep tension between the establishment and the idealistic wing of the party, the progressive wing. You saw it in 16 when they cheated Bernie. They cheated Bernie again in 2020. Like, Bernie won the first three contests, and then the Democrats came in and they rigged it for Biden in South Carolina. And then in 24, all the insiders said, no, no, we're going to do Biden. Oh, it turns out like that's impossible. Okay, well, we're just going to have Kamala. And there wasn't even a process. I think you're going to get a lot of frustration in 28. And with Trump not on the ticket, I don't know that they're really going to be able to rally. So they got some difficulty too. I think the task of the right is to outflank the left on economic populism. That's just the answer. It's literally that simple because the left has a lot of internal contradictions. It's not so easy for them because, you know, there's going to be this like Josh Shapiro, Zohran Mamdani problem is what I would call it. On the right, we really just need to capitalize on the fact that the left is sort of being dragged down by the identity politics for them. It's like the anti-white grievance politics, the radical stuff, the Antifa, transgender stuff. It's really hurting them with a lot of their people. But the right just needs to get out of their own way. They need to deliver on affordability, housing. They can't be telling the voters, if you can't afford to live in your city, you have to go and move somewhere else and work on an oil rig. Like, that's not going to work. So there's opportunity for the right, but they have to listen to people like me, people like you, people like Tucker. They need to kind of hear that we're at a red alert. Big opportunities, but also major risks if we don't make the smart decisions. So that's sort of my crystal ball for 28. I think that you know, the left is still not completely fortified yet, not consolidated, but they can, and you can see it, they're rallying because the right is making a lot of unforced errors. No reason it should be like this.
What do you make of Newsom being their main frontrunner?
I think that Newsom is somebody who, he's similar to DeSantis in the sense that he has a lot of weaknesses that people don't realize. He's very arrogant. If you watched his debate with DeSantis, that governor's debate about a year or two ago, he didn't come off great. He didn't do a great job. And people are excited about him. Like, I was excited about him because he's like a handsome, tall, white guy from the left, as opposed to the kind of race communism like a Stacey Abrams. So that's sort of interesting. But he ran California into the ground. He's not that intelligent. I don't even really think he's that likable. He seems frustrated and sort of like a little bit smug and arrogant. So I think like it's just like it was in the Republican primary last year. You never really know until a person is thrust onto the national stage how they're going to perform. And so right now, Newsom is the favorite, and he's obviously making moves. Pritzker, you know, he's on Ozempic so that he can run, and Buttigieg is looking at running. And, you know, so you have a lot of people that are thinking about it. And I think that Gavin Newsom, it reminds me sort of like Jeb Bush, where he's maybe just the one with name recognition. He's maybe just the one who's got a little bit of name ID. He's a little bit well-known. He's tall. Maybe he's got the look. And so I think that's just the default. I think, though, that once the primary starts, we're going to get a complete surprise.
No, I agree. So who do you think the front runner is on the Republican side in this big question?
Oh, it's Vance, without a question. It's Vance, and he's the one that's polling the highest, and he's the one that's favored in the betting markets. And it makes sense. He's the vice president, so he's sort of the heir apparent. You know, he's right now the favorite. But I think it's the same thing with him. You know, I'll give it to him. He's a good politician. And I think he's making a lot of strategic moves. He leaped in front of the Charlie Kirk funeral. And I don't want that to sound like it's cynical, but I do think that was a political move, even if it was sincere in some ways. I think it was smart. He's also leapt in front of, for example, the issue of Antifa, of the National Guard being deployed, immigration. When he was in Israel, he went to the church instead of the wall. Very calculated. And I think he's sort of been grooming the so-called dissident right. He's telling them what they want to hear. I think he's paving the way with the right-wing cultural.
It's not about credit. It's true. People that don't know, you had your big split with Shapiro and all them in the last 9 years. And then Groypers basically took over. TPUSA was evident. And now you look at Vance getting questions. It sounds like you wrote his responses. So I think actually the criticism, whereas he attacks you publicly, I think he's actually listening to you in policy.
Well, I don't know that he's listening to us, but I think it's strategic because, you know, you look at his actual policy, and I'll never forget this, and other people shouldn't either, and this is a concern. I'm always listening, and I'm always open-minded, but last year, Vance made a very intentional choice during the election to go to an anti-war think tank called the Quincy Institute, and they're not isolationists, but they're prioritizers. And there's a book by Barry Post, and it kind of gives their ideology, and they talk about prioritizing China or the Western Hemisphere. He goes to a think tank, which is very much against the Middle Eastern wars, and he gives a speech about putting a pro-Israel spin on America first and justifying the relationship with Israel on the basis of missile defense or arming them to fight Iran or integrating them into an Abraham alliance that can kind of share the responsibilities in the Middle East. And that was like a very intentional signal. He was signaling allegiance and loyalty to the Israel lobby.
Well, it was double-edged. He says, we're going to officially get out of the Middle East, but we'll back Israel as the proxy.
Right. And, you know, and I don't know if I agree with that necessarily, because I don't think that that's even possible. And I think that this year has sort of shown the limitations of that idea, because Trump is trying to extricate us from the region and Netanyahu wants us to fight Iran. And so I don't know how simple that is to say, well, we're just going to hand it off to Israel. I think Israel's always going to kind of need our help and they're always going to demand more. So it's a question. And I think that Vance, he's acutely aware of the fact that public sentiment is turning against Israel, and that's why he didn't condemn Tucker. That's why when he was asked about it, he actually went and quote tweeted some Jewish journalist who was attacking Buckley, Tucker's son, who works for Vance in the press office. That was a very telling response. And so now Vance is pivoting, and now he's signaling to the Groyper-aligned Gen Z or the Groyper-aligned millennials and Xers who are very critical of Israel. And I think that's a very strategic choice. I guess the question is in 28.
Well, I don't think there's a think. It's not about tooting your horn, because, you know, it's a wave you rode in on, but you were so much of the wave as well. You didn't just surf in. You were a big part of the wave. I can tell you, I've met with people at the highest levels of government, highest levels of tech, and they want to talk about you. The door closes, and I have these private meetings. I'm not selling out to folks. I have these meetings. And they want to talk about you. So we come back. I want to talk about where this goes, how you see this unfolding, and how weird it is in your 10 years being involved in politics to now be already right at the top of it, and how surreal that is, and how you're going to use your power for what? I just want to stabilize stuff. I want to educate the public. It's fun to, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but it's fun to have conflict to get more power. But the more power I got, the more I learned to, like, use it very, very wisely for stability. We'll be right back with InfoWars. So all of this is very paradoxical. I mean, I want Trump to succeed. I know he's way better than Kamala Harris. But if he doesn't take down the deep state, if he doesn't prosecute the criminals, if he doesn't dismantle it, then they're just going to come back in a couple of years even more vengeful than ever, as they promised to do. So Nick Fuentes is our guest here talking about this. Nick, looking at the Democrats, looking at the globalists, looking at everything they're doing, we have Islam going into its expansionist phase, which has done many times in its history. Gets about 10% into a country, and then it acts friendly, then it attacks. It's allied with the left. And whereas I don't want to exterminate people of Gaza, I also don't want to bring them here. How do you split the baby here on the radical left, globalist Soros, Rothschild, combine, UN, allied with the Muslims? And then obviously I'm upset too as well about Israel meddling in our affairs. It becomes a kind of binary thing where you're supposed to pick either side. And I've said this, I don't want to jump into a pit of rattlesnakes or water moccasins or cobras. It's really become polarizing. How do you see the future world system, the different power blocks that are out there?
Well, in terms of the Muslims, I continue to believe this is really not a major problem for the United States. Just in terms of pure numbers, Muslims are about 1% of the United States and concentrated in a few enclaves like in Minneapolis and in Dearborn. And of course, there's a lot of them in New York, and there's even some in Chicago and Texas. There's a big story about that grand mosque they're trying to build. And of course, I don't like that. But even in the context of the demographic problem, the biggest immigrant groups into the United States in the past 30 years, it's Mexicans, Indians, Chinese, Northern Triangle, Filipino, like those are the major groups. And so if you're talking about America changing demographically or culturally, it's a Latin American and an Asian problem. It's a Chinese and an Indian problem. In Europe, that is where they have a Muslim problem. That is where they have Pakistanis and Middle Easterners and Africans pouring in by the millions. And they represent most of the non-white population in those places. And so there, I think that's totally true, and it's a real problem. Over here in the United States, I think that is basically a deflection. I think that any time that somebody talks about our Jewish elite, because we do have Jewish oligarchs like Larry Ellison and Mary Madelson and others, every time somebody talks about that, we get someone like Laura Loomer screaming about the Muslim Brotherhood and Mark Levin screaming about Qatar and talking about the Muslim call to prayer. And I'm with you in the sense that, of course, I don't want a Muslim invasion of the United States. It's also something that's not really happening in large numbers. And I also think that is something that is sort of trotted out. It's sort of like, look over here. It's a big diversion. And so, you know, in New York, it makes sense because you've got Zohran Mamdani becoming the mayor. But let's be honest. I mean, a lot of the people that supported him, I think it was like 60% of Jewish people under the age of 30 voted for Mamdani. Like an actually alarmingly high number.
Yeah, but doesn't that go to people claiming the Jews are all one big block? Most of them are total leftist communists, self-hating.
No, because I don't think they're one block, and I think that most people wouldn't say that. I think people would say that they have a lot of influence, though. And the common denominator, whether they're left-wing, right-wing, whether they're Israeli or they're in the diaspora, it's that they have this ethnic self-interest. And so to me, the Muslim thing is just like a complete non-issue in the United States as of right now. I think it's the definition of scaremongering, basically, because it's more foreign. And people like to bring that up because it's a different religion, different civilization, different alphabet. They like to bring that up to basically scaremonger and short circuit rationality, because what everybody's watching is that Netanyahu is going to make his fifth visit to the White House, and we're bombing Somalia, and we're bombing Syria, and we're bombing Lebanon and Gaza and Iran. And, you know, we're doing all these things. We're shutting down the universities. In Northwestern here in Evanston, they say that you have to take like a pro-Israel training course to get admitted in the university. And I look at the Israelis very similarly to how I look at the Muslims. Different alphabet, different civilization, history of hatred and animosity against the West. I look at them basically the same, and they actually have all the cards. They seem to have far more influence than the Muslims. To the extent that Muslims have influence, well, they're bribing the Trump government. I mean, you got to lay that the blame at the feet of the Trump government, which is, you know, probably taking bribes. It's true from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia. What do you call it when Trump goes on that tour and then they bring the Saudis over here and they're going to make Saudi a major non-NATO ally and they're going to give a defense guarantee to Qatar. I mean, so I mean, that's where I would train my fire if I was even going to begin to talk about the Muslim issue. It's not a demographic problem. It's a bribery problem. And, you know, the Israelis are somewhat correct about that. They exaggerate it, but that's definitely real, and that's definitely
sure,
happening.
Sure, well, that's so. My point. It's just not just Israel manipulating us. It's the China, it's the Muslims, it's the EU, it's the globalists, it's BlackRock, exactly, all of it. So it's all healthy to look at it all. I remember my question before we went to break, and I forgot it. We'll go back to this. So what has it been like for you in your 10 years of politics to now have somebody come in January of this year try to kill you? To be demonized all over the news, have Chuckie Schumer saying they want to pass a resolution against you. What is that like at 26, 27 years old?
Unfortunately for me, it's nothing new. I've been dealing with this for 10 years, and I've just been dealing it with now at a much higher level. As I've gained more notoriety and more infamy, I'm just dealing with it on a greater scale. And I would say that... for me, it's nothing new, but it should shock people because it reminds you that we really don't actually have an open society or a free political system. Everybody thinks that we do because we have the First and Second Amendment, and we have a general culture of permissiveness and licentiousness, and it's a pretty liberal society. But you tend to realize that the moment that you attack the foundations of our political order— which is this like civil rights thing, which was created
in the
60s.
That's right. You got free speech and do all sorts of horrible stuff. But the minute you go after power, you don't have it. They're coming after you.
Exactly. And you know about this as well. You know about this better than anybody, which is you get a level of influence and power and you're independent. You're not, you did not get approved by the gatekeepers. You're not backed by, you know, money and corporations, big advertisers, whatever. If you are independent and you have influence and you start saying things that are against one of these major factions or the people that run the country, then they destroy you and they don't play fair. It's open political warfare. They manipulate and bend the rules of the system, and it's lawfare or it's a smear campaign. They hire a private investigator. They try to get blackmail on you. Project Veritas just came out, I think it was last week, and they said that the DOJ, it was Bill Barr, someone associated with Bill Barr.
Bill Barr's daughter targeting Candace Owens.
Exactly, and saying we need to get blackmail. Exactly, on Candace Owens. So whether it's a defamation suit against you or blackmail against Candace Owens or, you know, the many hit pieces about me promoted on Influenceable, calling me a Fed, simultaneously while I'm being attacked by the federal government, they have a full menu, a full spectrum of options, and you realize you don't really have freedom. And that's why, you know, I think James O'Keefe actually had a great clip about this from, you know, now he's at OMG, O'Keefe Media Group. He said, what is the truth worth to you? He said, the price has to be your life, because if it isn't, they will buy you out. They will threaten you. They will intimidate you. And this is why we don't have sovereignty. This
well,
is why we don't have-
Well, you made this point about the ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center. We have the Southern Poverty Law Center. Hire one of our employees, been here for 10 years, infiltrate, jack into all the cameras for a year, found nothing corrupt watching us. We don't have like in the rooms, but in the hallways and outside. And they just published it all. Totally illegal, totally criminal. We're filing suit on them, like probably within a week, all of them. But civil rights violations, conspiracy against rights, all around with the DOJ. But I saw a clip from you a few days ago. I don't know when you did it, but I watched a live show sometimes using these clips. You were explaining, like, they go through and they hire these people, and they like Jared Holt, and they just... And then they contact everybody in your family, everybody you know. They find somebody to then pay them off to go lie about you. I mean, this is people, and we're not playing victim here. We just need to know how nasty these people are. And people say, oh, why don't more people stand up? Because when you come prominent, folks, they literally come after you and stalk the living hell out of you.
And you're so right that it isn't about victimization, because I get that a lot. I talk about these things and people say, oh, you're playing the victim, or, oh, you know, you're complaining. And you're right. It's about explaining the anatomy of our political system, which is when there is dissent, when you go against the system, this is how, you know, in almost like It's like a blueprint in excruciating detail. This is how they will escalate it. This is how they will respond to that. And this is how they operate. It's nonprofits funded by billionaires, and in some cases, even funded by Congress, funded by the State Department. And they're hired for the sake of, you know, they call it information war. They call it, you know, countering extremism, countering domestic violent extremism. You know, they have all these different jargon, technological ways of describing it. But the goal is basically to suppress anybody that gains influence and is against the system. And you're right. They have a menu of options like that, whether it's they pull up the clips and they're going to use that to attack your reputation, or they're going to find an angle. They're going to find a plaintiff, and they're going to bring a case against you, which is what happened in your case. Or they'll just straight up kill you, which, you know, who knows what happened in my house a year ago, or what happened to Charlie Kirk for that matter, or what happened to a lot of these different people. That's how they operate. And people just need to understand that something is fundamentally wrong with the society. So, I mean, to me, that having done this for 10 years, that's kind of the stark realization. That's what shocks people the most. Because I do these interviews with young guys and even older people in the political system, and you tell them what happens, like, I can't get a bank account. I was on the no-fly list. Then they don't believe it. And the first response you should.
Go ahead.
I was going to say their first response is, well, you should sue. You should file a lawsuit. That shouldn't be legal. And they have no idea. It's like you're going up against people that have limitless resources. That's the whole point. They have literally unlimited money to throw at the best law firms, or it's the government and they're funded by the taxpayer. And so people just have no clue.
So let me raise this. It's not working anymore. Populists are winning all over the planet. People are going super hardcore against the establishment. A, do you agree with that? And then B, does the establishment realize how much trouble they're in? And then C, I've been sent this article like three times by people the last day. Not this one, the one before. Oh, Nick Fuentes is two-faced. Nick Fuentes says one thing on one show, one thing on another. No, I say stuff. They take it out of context. And they say, oh, look, but he said this over here. I know what you do. Sometimes you make jokes and stuff and take it out of context. But now they're going with this thing of like, he's deceiving people because you have, you know, these multiple faces. And they've tried that with me as well. You want to explain that?
Yeah, I saw that in the Free Press. I couldn't even read it because it's behind a paywall. But I've been getting this for 10 years. It used to be on my Wikipedia page. And they would say he uses jokes and irony to conceal his real viewpoints. He really is a Nazi, but you'd never know it because he acts like a really nice guy and has reasonable viewpoints when you talk to him on a show. And it's almost like you have to then go back and explain the concept of like jokes or context. And, you know, Ben Shapiro did this a couple weeks ago. He played some of my clips on his stream, and every single one was about 4 seconds. I think the average duration of the clips he played was between 4 and 6 seconds. I do a 3-hour stream 5 nights a week for 10 years. And what happens in a show is everybody knows.
Newsflash. If you're ever watching a show, my show, anybody's, and you're seeing 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds, you're being deceived. That's why the average clip we play is like 3 minutes. Folks, that is the ultimate way to deceive. And they've done that over and over again. Expand on that.
We're so right, and it should go without saying, because divorced from context, you can make anything sound like anything. And
they'll even do trials, they would play like 4-second clips.
I remember it well. And, you know, it's no different than when you take something which is being said in jest and then you read out the transcript. And so they'll take a clip where I'm laughing and grinning and I'm being funny. And I might even say at the other side of it, I might say, no, I'm just kidding. Obviously, blah, blah, blah. But when you cut that out and then read the transcript, they say, this guy's he's pro-rape, pro-genocide, pro-Hitler, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, if you go on a show.
I saw you a few months ago, and even some of the Groybers to score points did it. You were like explaining, and maybe we're wrong now. You're like, look, there's no evidence Israel killed Kirk. If there is, we'll expose it. We don't know yet. And you people saying I work for Israel are idiots, and you're low IQ, and you're morons. Maybe I'll just join the Jews, because at least they're organized. You were being sarcastic. They all went crazy and said, oh, God, he works for the Jews. It's like, no, it's the point of making the issue. Like, am I on the wrong team? You people are so dumb. So exactly. But even they still ran with it because it's this cheap trick thing. I would never take a 5-second clip just to have a big hit and lie about somebody because I don't want to be discredited. I want to actually be honest. But it's really a big problem.
It's a huge problem. And the good news is I think people are starting to wake up because I see these kind of out of context clips and I see all the comments are saying, oh, nice, you edited down to 8 seconds. What's that all about? So I think people are starting to become aware. That being said, I don't think that will ever go out of fashion because the vast majority of people have such a limited attention span and are quick to judge and everything like that. It's just a tragedy. The comments is just how people are. Tragedy of the masses of the goy. That's just how they operate. So on some level, we're always going to have that. But I think people are starting to smarten up and see what's going on because that kind of stuff just doesn't have the same currency anymore. And I think that we should play the same game. We do the same thing. The difference is we take people at their word. When Mark Levin goes up at RJC, which he did a few weeks ago, and he says, we're going to make our decisions. We're going to see who's associating with who, and we cancel people all the time. It's like, okay, so we're going to take that clip, and we're going to blow it up everywhere, and the difference is that is true to what you're actually saying and actually believe.
The difference is it's a two-minute clip. Yeah, it's in context. So let me raise that point. How pathetic is it for Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro, who literally have 5% of their previous audience, they even admit that, what must it be like with all their billionaire backers to know the whole world's turned against them and instead they double down and become a stereotype?
It has to be very sad. I can't imagine what it's like working in one of those offices, a Daily Wire, because you got to remember, and I know you do, Mark Levin and Shapiro, these guys were on top 10 years ago. Certainly Mark Levin, you had a huge radio show.
And they were supporting radio. Four Shots. They were supporting Taking Me Off the Air. I'll never forget it.
Oh, and every war you can imagine and the rhinos and everything. And Shapiro was supposed to be the wonder kid. He was supposed to be the next generation. And now you look at their show. I think I watched a Daily Wire live stream. It was a four-way stream with all their hosts, Walsh, Knowles, Klavan, Shapiro. And I think put together, they had 1,000 concurrent viewers, 1,000 on YouTube with their millions of subscribers, all the channels simultaneously streaming. They couldn't get 1,000 concurrent viewers. And you got to say, wow, I mean, how far they have fallen. So it's got to be very depressing. And all they know how to do is double down. This would be the opportunity where you debate someone like me, or you go to Turning Point and you debate Tucker, like whatever.
Yeah, let's raise
this
that. Remember Levin moment. Like, I'm bigger than you, Tucker. I won't legitimize you. Tucker's like 50 times bigger. I'm not going to debate you. Like, how cowardly to not go debate him and then say, because Tucker said what Israel's done is illegal, he goes, how dare you threaten my stepson? If I see you in person, I'm going to kick your ass. Didn't say anything about a stepson. He sounds completely unhinged.
They are unhinged, and that's because they don't know how to do anything other than double down. They have not had to defend their positions for probably their entire lives. And they are used to getting away with everything and being above scrutiny and above skepticism. They didn't have to defend their position. And in the past, all they would do is these kinds of word games that we've all figured out now and the doubling down, more aggressive, more intensity. And, they're throwing out that old playbook and it just isn't working anymore. So I actually, sir, it would be pitiable if they weren't the worst people in the world. And by that, I mean these people like Levin and Shapiro, who are so nasty and so hateful. I mean, honestly, the most hateful people in the country. It would be sad if they didn't act like that. So, I think they're finished. I don't know where the next audience is. Even if they engage in censorship, even if they engage in some of these kind of convoluted things that they're trying to do now, I don't know what audience under the age of 75 is ever going to watch Mark Levin ever again, or what audience under the age of 35 or 40 is going to watch Shapiro. I just think it's cooked. And once you get, once the toothpaste comes out of the tube, it doesn't go back in. So the idea that people are going to come back around because Matt Walsh and Shapiro are talking about McDonald's and Burger King or AI, it just isn't going to happen. So, that's why I think they really either need to engage And they need to admit, okay, we lost the country. We're going to have to humbly engage them and persuade them to get it back and make an argument. And that might hasten their demise.
They threaten everybody. Because here's my deal. You and I both, without even talking, a few days after Kirk's kill, we're like, we can't say Israel did it. Whole thing looks suspicious. Let's figure it out. Then you have Levin and all them saying, watch out. We're going to get you. We're going to take, you know, all these other bizarre, you know, threatening statements. And then you have to start asking, well, then maybe people are right to say that. But look at this. ISI invited students to dinner with Alex Jones and Tucker. You have Levin. This is just today. Like he said he would do 2 weeks ago, running around policing. A college showed my interview at dinner with young conservatives with Tucker a month and a half ago, and they're literally freaking out, calling for them all to basically be thrown out of college. I mean, doesn't he know the Streisand effect of that? Like, he's picking on college students because they watched an interview with me and Tucker that was all about Russia and China. It wasn't really about Israel. This is crazy power tripping here. This will make all the students even more want to watch us.
I would say that. I think there's definitely some truth to that because people are going to see this and say this. It's going to turn a lot of people against Levin and Shapiro and that crowd. Here's what I will say, though. As long as they hold all the cards, this will work. And Ross Douthat at New York Times, he said it explicitly in the New York Times a few weeks ago. You know, he's ostensibly a conservative. He said, how do we fight Nick Fuentes and the Groypers? He said, well, we've already lost the social media battle. We're not going to have control over censorship and blacklisting in the way that we did 5 years ago. He said, so that's over. We need to retreat. He said, what we can control is these bottlenecks. He said, we can control who is hired, who is promoted, who is accepted inside the institutions of power. So he said, that is where we still have influence. That is where we can still have some degree of gatekeeping power. So he said, we can control who works in think tanks, who works in congressional offices, who works on campaigns. And I would imagine that also extends to who gets to be in college, who gets to be at these college Republicans.
But what's amazing is, I agree, he said that, I remember you covering it, but this is a major strategic retreat.
It is. It certainly is. But my point is, we have to press the advantage with precision, because a lot of people are going to fall back and say, oh, well, this is going to backfire. They're just making people hate them more. And they'll say, oh, it's a Streisand effect, so we're winning. And I would say we need to, if they're retreating, we need to press the advantage and say, all the more reason, get in college Republicans, get on campaigns, get in the congressional offices, the think tanks, ISI. Hide your power level. They're going to retreat back to that. We have to storm and break down that wall too and penetrate the inner sanctum, because that they're guarding it because that's where the treasure is. They're guarding it because that's where the power is. So I totally agree with you. It's a huge retreat, huge tactical defeat on their part, but it's not enough to now say, oh, okay, well, the genie doesn't go back in the bottle. We won the argument. Everyone's against them. We now need the right people in the right places. And those are the places they're trying to gatekeep and defend.
No, I agree. If you look at William F. Buckley, the CIA and all of it, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they went in to take over the colleges to control conservatism. So they're basically retreating as the neocons back to their first redoubt. Like you said, like a ring city, they're going back to their final fortress. I just wish to bypass the whole thing, just make it about Americana, free market, America first, and just not have it about a fight about that. But they're making it about that. And so regardless, as long as we press the attack, what do they do? Do they ever capitulate, or they just get more and more radical?
It's hard to say. It's unpredictable. And I think that so far they've shown their hand, which is they only get more radical. I don't see a lot of capitulation at all. And I don't even see a willingness to capitulate. It's like you said, they're actually emotionally unhinged. It's personal for them. You look at a guy like Shapiro and Mark Levin, they're like foaming at the mouth, like they're angry, they're furious. And so I think they're only going to keep doubling down. And I think we have to keep matching their ferocity, not with hatred and not with violence or cruelty, but we have to match their ferocity with righteousness. And I'm with you. It's got to be about America. It's got to be about God. It's got to be about all the things that we love. But we have to match the intensity
on the
other
side. All right, Nick J. Fuentes on Rumble. Let's come back with other big topics, calls, and comments. Stay with us. Gilbert, Joel, Chad, Charles, Charles, Andrew, Clown Car, Jacob. You were on before, Nick, but these are all topics you can comment on anything. Smart guy. We want to hit Venezuela. We want to hit a lot of the other stuff that's happening. But in the short segment, on the trajectory Israel's on, the most unpopular country in the world now, they have nuclear weapons, the sanction option. I don't want to destroy Israel. I just want Israel to stop putting everybody on a collision course. But just looking at where this goes, the doubling down, it doesn't look good for Israel in just a few years. Because I've seen you say, oh, well, the young people are all right-wing or left-wing anti-Israel. It's not just young people. It's massively moving into the middle-age and even old people. It's a chain reaction. So looking at this, where do you see Israel in 10 years?
I think it really depends on the outcome of the current conflict, because it would seem that after 2023, they're doing this go for broke once and for all campaign to destroy all of their enemies, which I think they believe are headquartered in Iran. And so that's Hezbollah, that's the Assad regime, these Shiite groups in Iraq, Syria, and also the Houthis. If they are successful in decapitating the Iranian regime, denuclearizing them, they'll be able to roll back these proxies. And what they're talking about is a significant expansion. Today, Netanyahu came out and said they want a demilitarized zone from Damascus to the Purple Zone. So they want southern Syria. They want southern Lebanon, south of the Litani River. They want the West Bank and Gaza. That's a pretty significant expansion of Israeli territory. And if they're successful in taking out Iran and they're able to get this kind of control over the region, it's going to be enormously profitable for them. It's going to be profitable because they would be the leader of the Abraham Alliance. And so all the AI and the energy revenue, all the sovereign wealth that is in the Gulf, it's going to flow into Israel. They'll be the leader. And they'll also benefit from the trade routes, from the Belt and Road, from the India-Middle East-Europe corridor. So I think that one pathway is that they could be extremely successful if they're able to make this happen. The other path, if they're not able to diminish Iran, is that you're right, they're going to be completely ostracized. They have earned no goodwill from any of their neighbors or the rest of the world. Turkey is against them. Saudi Arabia is unhappy with them. Qatar got bombed by them. And if Iran remains in power, like, there's never going to be a reconciliation between those countries. And of course, now they're alienated with Americans and they're not going to count on that unconditional support. So I think that it really all goes down to whether they're going to be successful, because if they're not, they're going to be in real trouble and they're going to have to repair all those relations over time. And it's going to cost them a lot of political capital. Even Egypt is unhappy with them. I forgot to throw that one in there. So I would say that right now the jury is still out. And this is why I'm very deeply concerned about what is happening with the Trump administration, because Israel knows the stakes. Netanyahu knows the stakes. The people, and whether Netanyahu stays or goes, whether he gets this pardon or not, the next prime minister will know it too. And the question is there enough of an understanding in the Trump administration, enough energy and pushback that they're going to be able to restrain Israel and keep them from kind of driving the traffic here for the United States. So that's kind of my tenure.
In general, though, in all the demographics, Israel is the most unpopular country in the world. It's getting worse by the minute. How do they respond to that?
Increasingly, I think that they're decoupling from the United States. This is why even they say they don't want the foreign aid anymore. They want a 20-year memorandum of understanding. And they're going to, like all the other middle powers, they're going to have to play both sides, I think. They're going to have to play China, India off of the United States, which is what the other countries do. It's what Saudi Arabia does. It's what Turkey does. It's what Brazil does. And I think that's kind of treacherous, but this is how they play. So they're losing support from us. They'll try and pick it up from the other countries. And they're a superpower in their own right. So I don't think they'll have trouble picking up investment or political support from the East, from the other bloc. So I think, like,
no,
everybody else, they're
back in 60 seconds. And so think about that. Then you have the Christian Zionists that literally say our souls depend on supporting Israel. And Israel's literally laughing at you. It's absolutely insane. Nick Fuentes is our guest. Your calls, your comments, so much more news coming up. 60 seconds. Stay with us. So when I say this, this isn't hype. And I'm not glazing Nick Fuentes or trying to puff his ego. He knows this because he goes out in public. I get multiple calls a day from high-powered people that want me to tell them, you know, is Nick Fuentes good or bad or what's going on with him? And most of the time they go, I heard he's this horrible person that actually went and saw what he said, and I agree with him. I mean, even take Steve Bannon, like, saw his debate with Dinesh D'Souza, and I like Dinesh, you know, Dinesh 25 years, wiped the floor with him. Dinesh had a bunch of talking points, and I know all the Middle Eastern stuff, and I know the countries, and I know everything Nick said was true, but, you know, his knowledge comes and goes. I mean, I couldn't muster up 10% of what he does. Of course, he's 26, so he's got that young brain, but I know he's right, and Steve Bannon does, so you got to give respect where it's due, and Nick didn't support it when I got censored. Everybody else basically did. So, but I did call Nick about a month before Kirk got killed. And I said, I don't remember the whole conversation, but I said, let me tell you and Charlie Kirk are the future. And I said, I'm not a cowardly person. I don't live in fear. I just said, I have a feeling. I said, you need to be very, very careful. And you need to really watch yourself and don't put yourself in danger for no reason. And, you know, Nick, listen to me, but I just have an understanding of the zeitgeist. I always have. And it's so healthy what Nick's done. You know, people try to guilt me having Nick Fuentes on. Every time I have him on, I get hundreds of emails, calls. What are you doing having Hitler on? And I made the joke, maybe Hitler when he was in there with Kanye. And I'm just like, look at this compilation. In fact, I said I'd get to this. Let's play this before we get to the other stuff in your calls. A couple days ago, Elon Musk put this out, and I'm not going to play the whole thing. It's like, you know, 5 minutes of headlines, mainstream news saying whites are inherently degenerate, our genetics are bad, we're scum, we should be eradicated. And I have all the videos of the professors and them saying it. And so you can't point your finger at Nick Fuentes then and say because he stands up for himself, he's bad, but he's mild compared to other people. But that's why they don't like him, is because he's intellectually defeating them. I mean, Hitler was a race-based monopolist eugenics person, but he didn't publicly say all this stuff. The left goes further than Hitler in their declaration of war against white people. Now, I tell you, I got black listeners, Hispanic listeners, everybody. I love them. They love me. And what's crazy is they see Nick and they get it because they actually watch Nick and what he says rather than what they say Nick said. But it really is the David versus Goliath story to watch them throw everything they've got at Nick and he just gets stronger. And I'll say this, I always admire people who I know have gone through what I've gone through and gone through in some cases worse things than I have and you know, myself other things, but it's the fellow traveler thing. And it's so exciting to be persecuted and to know God's real and come through it. But Nick, what is it coming out of BlackRock, coming out of the leftist Jewish lobby, all of it, that is anti-European? What is it? Why does it keep happening? And don't they know that it was going to conjure? They're lucky they got a Nick Fuentes. In fact, even Tucker said, they said, you know, he's pretty moderate and smart and intellectual. There's things you think Nick Fuentes is dangerous. There's a lot more dangerous things you're conjuring up. I mean, I can imagine. It's like some right-wing Islamic alliance or something in the future. I mean, it's crazy that these people go for total power. They see anything else that's successful as a threat. Whereas if something's successful, I just want to work with it and adopt it and be part of it. I don't get mad, you know, that somebody's got something better than what I've got. I just want to be part of it. And I can see if I was refused and rebuffed it, but that's a long rant, though. But what is it like to persevere and come through all this? So I have a few peers, and you're definitely one of them, and way younger than I, so I just it's amazing. Because at 26, I had a big show, but nothing like the six you've had. So it's very paradoxical because there's very few people that have done what I've done, and then you've done stuff even more at your age. I just have told you need to keep yourself alive, buddy, because let me tell you, this is a serious situation. So that's quite a rant there. It's a lot of questions there. How do you respond to it?
Well, I appreciate the kind words. And likewise, you know, over the years, we've had sort of a strange relationship over many different issues and things like when we did Yay 24 and a lot of different things. And I know that we have our disagreements. I think we generally agree on most things, though. And I know that some of your people criticize me, some of my people criticize you, but I think there's always been a mutual respect because we're both on the same journey, in a sense. We're both taking the hits, and we've both been kind of through the gamut of what they've thrown at us. And I think you weigh more than me, the way they're coming for your company and this billion-dollar lawsuit. It's totally insane. So I totally agree with that. As far as where the right wing is headed with the anti-white stuff and how I feel about it, I started my show 10 years ago because as the youngest guy, as the 18-year-old, now I'm not even the youngest guy. I'm a younger guy, but I'm not the youngest. But as an 18-year-old coming of age during the Trump election and the rise of the alt-right, and really at the, I would say at the peak of wokeness, which is synonymous with anti-white, anti-Christian, anti-straight white male, people my age at that time just had our finger on the pulse. We said our entire life, we had been indoctrinated with this diversity stuff. And increasingly, it was becoming less pro-black and brown and much more anti-white. And people forget how bad it was. I mean, I have to remind people, I have to remind myself that in 2017, it felt like history was moving in one direction and nothing on earth could change its course. And it was going to be more anti-white, more anti-male, more anti-Christian, more degenerate. And it did keep going in that direction for many years. It went from pro-gay to pro-trans. It went from, you know, pro-black to this BLM insanity. Everything was getting worse. And I remember at that time, it straight up radicalized me because I said, anti-white, hey, I'm white. And I'm proud to be white, and white people built the country. All the kind of stuff that is mainstream now, back then it was super controversial to say something is wrong here. Like, why is it okay to only attack white people and say white people should have fewer kids? They're going extinct, and that's a good thing. They're going to become a minority, and then Republicans can never win again. I said, this is shocking and outrageous, and it seems like no one's talking about it. I distinctly remember realizing that whites would become a minority in America. And thinking about the political ramifications first, thinking about how that would empower Democrats forever. And I remember thinking, am I the only one who has discovered this? Like, why isn't anyone doing anything about this? I remember reading like Ann Coulter and Pat Buchanan and those people at that time and saying, there has to be surely some effort by Republicans to reverse this or fight it. And it just wasn't happening. I had to go out and do it myself. And I did that by supporting the Trump movement and then making it a little edgier, a little bit more radical. Let me ask
you this then. Do you think there's a second, third order thing with the social engineers? Or were they that arrogant to think this wouldn't have a backlash? Because now the backlash is so powerful, I know they're scared.
I think it really was arrogance. And maybe you would ascribe more of an intention behind it than I would. But I think at that time, it was just straight up hubris because the left was totally dominant and they controlled Hollywood and they controlled the media. And the Republican Party was a horrible brand. You know, in 2014, who wanted to be a Republican? Nobody. The Republican Party was corny and stodgy and lame, and people thought it represented the rich and like crazy evangelicals. I mean, that's what Hollywood would say about it. It was a horrible brand. Even Republicans didn't like it. And then Trump came around in 16 and turned all that on its head because he's a celebrity billionaire, objectively cool. And he basically took the Republican Party and made it the winning brand and defeated the Democrats.
And now he's given up so much of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's forfeited that. I think that they really just got too cocky and they made a lot of unforced errors. And they gave up the game to Trump. And over 10, 12 years, Trump is totally flipped
that. Well, let me ask
you
this. I'm sure you've noticed something. You talk about it. Have you seen the record numbers of black people, Hispanics, and others that listen to you and me that actually get it? I mean,
I have, yeah.
What's going on there?
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny because there's a lot of people that
attack me. I think it's a sense of fairness.
I don't know that it's fairness. I think it's more that they're not woke. Honestly, I think that blacks and browns are not woke like white people are. And by that, I mean, if you and I say...
Guilt. They're not into the leftist religion.
Well, the guilt and the sensitivity, you know, like with white people, if you say something racist, sexist, homophobic, you know, beta males and white women are going to freak out. They're going to say, what did you just say? I can't believe you. And I think that brown and black people just don't have that, because black people have been used to doing whatever they want forever, and they could say whatever they want and do whatever they want. And so when a white guy kind of gives them the same energy, like, hey, I'm not one of these woke tards, they love it. And I think Hispanics, it's the same way. And they're also pretty conservative. Like, from, I know that's like a meme, but it's true that Hispanics and blacks have always been very socially conservative. They're
that's right. The communists got pissed they couldn't get the blacks to become communists in this country.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, blacks are socialist, but they're not down with this, like, LGBT feminist stuff. They're not down with the pronoun. Like, they're not with that. And yeah, they want more government programs. Like, they think everything should be free, but they also don't want to be preached to by some, like, white Jewish liberal woman or some, like, white beta male bisexual guy. Like, they don't want to deal with that kind of thing. And I think, you know, maybe they don't agree with me on everything, but they say, oh, I like this guy because he doesn't care. Like, he doesn't care about the political correctness. In many ways, that's why they respect Trump. They kind of just respect someone that's a G, you know, someone that doesn't care as much about that stuff. So I think it's an attitude maybe that they like.
Do you think Hakeem Jeffries realizes how much trouble he's in?
Maybe they're in trouble. Then again, maybe they're going to take back the House. Maybe they're going to run the government in 2028. I don't know. So I think it really could go either way. It depends on where the Republican Party takes it.
So let's do this. If you were President Trump right now, what would you do?
If I'm President Trump, I'm going to deport everybody. I'm going to restrain Israel. I'm going to force them to end all the hostilities. And I know they achieved this deal in Gaza, but that's not over by a long shot. And then I would do something with the affordability crisis. You got to address healthcare, infrastructure, jobs. I don't know what that looks like in terms of like a full spectrum approach. I would articulate a trade doctrine that's stable and predictable so that investment can start flowing, money can increase its velocity. But you really got to start to think more about the economy. I would drop the war in Venezuela and I'd refocus on the war against poverty in America. So, in other words, I would put the people first. I would listen. And what the people said in this off-year election is we want affordability. You know, there's so many bellwethers here about where the economy is. There's a housing bubble. The Black Friday spending, even though the volume was high in terms of the number of people participating, was much lower. People are buying on credit. They're doing this, you know, pay later stuff. And then you have the jobs report from October, which they're not even releasing. Allegedly, we lost 50,000 jobs. If you don't count the data centers, there's been no job growth at all. And so the signs are there. We're in trouble. Bitcoin is crashing. I would really get back to the drawing board on what we're doing with trade.
No, I agree.
And what we're doing,
and the polls
with the
show they don't like Trump saying everything's wonderful, we fixed inflation. No, you didn't. He's doing fixes that take time. Stop saying it's fixed. That's the thing that pisses people off. Now let's shift gears before we go to calls into Somalia. You want to get into that. Trump, during his cabinet meeting just an hour ago, Trump on Somalia immigrants. Here's what he had to say.
And they contribute nothing. The welfare is like 88%. They contribute nothing. I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you, okay? Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country is no good for a reason. Their country stinks, and we don't want them in our country. I could say that about other countries, too. I could say it about other countries, too. We don't want them to help. We have to rebuild our country. You know, our country's at a tipping point. We could go bad. We're at a tipping point. I don't know if people mind me saying that, but I'm saying it. We could go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country.
Wow.
Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage.
Wow.
Her friends are garbage.
Wow.
These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. These are people that do nothing but complain. They complain. And from where they came from, they got nothing. You know, they came from paradise, and they said, this isn't paradise. But when they come from hell, and they complain and do nothing but bitch, we don't want them in our country. Let them go back to where they came from and fix it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Well, he ended the event with that. So I might just air that on loop tomorrow for 4 hours. That's the Trump we want. Don't be politically correct. Stop bowing down. Do what he just did. Nick, that was powerful. That's the old Trump. That's the old Trump 2.0. What do you make of that?
Yeah, where's this guy been for the past 5 years? I think that's what everybody's thinking. I love it. And he hit every note because it's so true. These people come from a broken country. They come here and they mess up our country. Everybody knows they don't contribute. And for all the statistics,
and they run
people
us down
say, well,
how we're the...
Well, and that's the best part. They come here from a horrible country. They don't contribute. And then they're not even grateful. There's no gratitude. There's no reverence. There's no appreciation. And he's right. Ilhan Omar, that other one that just ran for mayor, they're not loyal to America. They don't even like America. And he's right. All they do is whine and complain. And I love that he says, all they do is bitch. It's true. That's all they do. And we don't want him here. Does anybody think America's made better by a bunch of Somalian immigrants? We don't want him here. It's just not a good idea. Don't need him.
And it's so healthy to start differentiating and bring back common sense. That was so revolutionary. Wow.
It is, but now we need to see something done about it. They need to go into Minneapolis and liberate the city, because otherwise it's all talk. Okay, it's a great statement. You know, that's what everybody wanted to say. It's very cathartic. It's like, you know, I feel good when I hear that. But if in 3 years, Minneapolis is still Somalian, I'm going to say WTF. What happened then?
By the way, do you know both the cops they hired that were Somali non-citizens killed people and lost their jobs within a few months?
Really?
I'm sorry about Somalis, folks. Let me just be honest. They literally admit it is a culture of slavery and piracy.
Well, and it's them. It's the Haitians. It's like, hey, remember the Haitians in Springfield? We don't want these people. Like, these are probably the two worst countries on earth, Haiti and Somalia. They don't have a functioning government. Somalia does not and has not had a legitimate central government in decades, and neither does Haiti. And yet we're bringing these people into the Midwest. Why? Why are we bringing them to Ohio and Minnesota? Well, they're bringing them in because they have a functional welfare state. They're bringing them in because you have good health care in Ohio and Minnesota, bringing them in because you have a generous welfare state. And we're waiting for the president, the actual President Trump, that is going to take them and remove them from the country completely. But, I'm not confident that that's going to happen. I'm waiting for the day when they send in ICE by the tens or hundreds of thousands, and they literally just take them all out. And one day you wake up and Minneapolis is no longer under Somalian occupation. I don't think that's going to happen, but it needs to. And so that's where I hear a statement like that, and you go, okay, so clearly you still have it in you. You know what we want to hear. You know what we want you to do. The 2016 Trump never left. You just need to flip a switch. But now you need to deliver. And so if you can deliver all these other things, deliver this, do what you need to do, but like make it happen, because if you remove these people, they're not coming back. If you take these people out of the country, you can violate every federal judge injunction, every Supreme Court ruling, whatever. If you just take these people and physically remove them, they're not coming back. Just do it and pardon yourself. Do it and pardon your people. But we just have to start getting them out.
And by the way, you're putting them into a wonderland. They all say how great Somalia is. You're doing them a favor.
Yeah, they're so proud, right? I mean, they're so proud of their culture and their heritage, and they're so much better than us. So let's just do them a favor. We'll get them a nice military cargo plane ride right back, and then we're going to slam the door shut so they're never tempted to return. I just want to see it happen. And it's frustrating that, you know, when you hear that, do you realize it? It's like, it's very pleasing to hear, but you also realize, oh, so Trump knows exactly what to say and exactly what to do. He's just not doing it every other day and 90% of the other times when it's not happening. So that's where it's sort of bittersweet.
No, I agree. But I'm starting to see a pivot, though. I think he's starting to swing back because he knows his poll numbers are in the toilet.
Well, I'm not going to say that until he delivers. I think this is what he does, which is he says these things and people go, oh, here we go. We're going to get that old Trump back. And it buys him another 6 months. And it's 6 months of letdown, 6 months of disappointment. I hope you're right. I hope he pivots and turns it around.
Well, they are having giant raids in Minneapolis right now.
Are they? How many people are being removed? I don't think
it's thousands.
They're talking about doing that.
No, it started. No, it just started. Here's the thing. Biden all gave him amnesty. Trump's revoking it.
Well, he's revoking their protected status so they could be deported. But we actually have to put them on the planes and get them out. But we're just not seeing those numbers. It's 300,000.
But in fairness, you know,
nothing.
The judges have been blocking it. I mean, they have ramped up enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, they're training more people. They're hiring more people. But the numbers are still so low. The average is like 1,000 per day. That's nothing. I mean, you need 10,000 a day. Realistically, to get even the 10 million under Biden. That's just to get us neutral. And then people want to say, what about self-deportations? What about them? We need to literally have massive operations and get these people out. And they say, well, you know, they're obstructing. Okay, like throw all those people in jail too. Wouldn't it be paradise if we woke up in 4 years and we were 10 million less immigrants and all these like left-wing agitators, all these horrible leftists were in prison for attacking ICE and throwing planters in front of their trucks? Like,
that's the Soros judges that are letting them out.
They should just disobey that. They don't have to listen to that. They should just disobey that. The Supreme Court intervened and said, you can't do these nationwide injunctions on every little thing. You got to go full Andrew Jackson and just disobey it. I mean, we're at a critical stage. We're in a crisis. It's time for the government to lay down the law. Time for the executive to execute.
No, I agree. Constitutional crisis time. All right, let's come back. I want to hit Venezuela briefly, and then we're going to take some calls, hit some of the comments and questions for Nick Fuentes. A real discussion. Notice there's been no infighting in this interview. Different personalities attacking each other. That's fun, and that gets ratings, but it doesn't move the needle towards liberty. We'll be right back. I'm Alex Jones, InfoWars.com. All right, Nick, I want to briefly hit Venezuela. I know you and I have overall agreed on the policy. I don't trust the intelligence agencies to do this, but I get hemispherically this. Like you said, this isn't neoconism, this is realism. But just briefly, and I'm not attacking you. You just make the joke like it's a debate, but it really isn't a debate, so I didn't call it a debate. I remember seeing you like a year ago, you know, Alex talks about Bilderberg Group and the globals, maybe 2 years ago, but he's like, you know, it's really this. But what about the big tech? What about the big banks? What about, you know, to me, there's that whole corporate globalist system that obviously Israel's heavily involved in, China and others. But you're a smart guy. You know your geopolitics. So certainly you understand that the heart of the Western globalist power structure is the big corporations. How do we deal with that wild card? I mean, I see Trump putting pressure on BlackRock, at least on the surface. States like Texas winning lawsuits against him for trying to cut our carbon output. I see Trump getting us out of the Paris Accords, that is so huge, getting inside the carbon taxes. That's incredibly positive. I mean, how do you respond to that power block of the overall globalist corporations?
Well, I mean, when you look at Trump, he's a pro-Wall Street candidate. I mean, he cut the corporate tax rate in 17. He extended the corporate tax cut again this year. And you look at the donors, you get Ken Griffin backing him. You got Tim Mellon, a banker, giving him $200 million. And who was at his inauguration? It was Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos. You know, it was big tech and little tech together. So to me, I look at Trump as basically at this point a pro-establishment figure. They're not afraid of him. The New York Times, the Washington Post, they don't give him, and no one talks about this, but they do not resist him half as much as they did 10 years ago. In 2016, when Trump ran the first time, you remember, it was brutal. Every day, the coverage was 99% negative.
No, I totally
negative,
agree that a lot of the establishment's capitulated, and Trump's danger is looking like establishment when he hasn't yet even won. So let me ask you this then. But the deep state, the Democrats, elements of the CIA, they're all trying to call a revolution, or you disagree with that? Because they're definitely trying to foam it, don't follow orders. They're definitely trying to set something up. I agree their power is diminished. Who makes up the kind of leftist leftovers?
Well, it's difficult to say because they seem to be very disorganized. And it's hard to say who's on what side at this point. You know, a lot of people came over to the right after October 7th, which is sort of interesting. You know, you had people like Bill Ackman, for example, who was a left-wing guy, now is on the right. He was a left-wing Jewish donor. Now he's on the right because of the whole Israel issue. So the question is, who is really left? I think that they've lost a lot of the institutional Jewish support. USAID got rolled up. So I think a lot of the money that came from the NGOs is drying up. The Trump administration is doing a good job of fighting back against that. So where are their power centers? Well, you could even say that Zuckerberg was a major booster for the Democrats in 20, $300 million from Zuckerberg Chan million, Foundation. Yeah. He didn't even put money in 24. He sat it out and he did the whole rebrand. He was like a tech bro, changed his look. So you've got Reid Hoffman, you've got Bloomberg, you've got Pritzker, you got Hollywood, and I'm sure there's a lot of holdovers, a lot of stay behinds in the CIA and in the, you know, the State Department and the federal bureaucracy. There are actually
really
still a ton.
But it really is a diminished headless horseman. I agree. It's like a decapitated chicken running around.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So it's hard to say who will then emerge and take leadership. Obama allegedly has been orchestrating a ton of meetings in D.C. Over the past week with Susan Rice and Victoria Nuland, for people to know who that is. And
but
a lot of other like
deck chairs of the Titanic.
Yeah. You know, so they're trying to get it back together.
So you're right, though. We should put all our pressure on Trump. When I asked the question, it was rhetorical at the first. But do it right, not fake stuff. Do real serious stuff like you're doing. You're right. Everything is about the populace we have in, putting pressure on them to stay true, because the left is basically on a suicide mission.
Well, yeah, and I just think that they're not the biggest threat right now. They're pretty disorganized. The biggest threat right now is that we're going to lose the initiative on the right. And what I basically want to do is fortify the right wing in the way that Trump did the first time. Because before Trump took the fight to Clinton, he first had to level the whole conservative movement. He had to fight Fox News with Roger Ailes at the head at the time. And he had to fight, you know, that whole constellation of think tanks that were dominant back then, the consultant class, as well as all the politicians, the Bush dynasty and the donor base.
But it
that
sounds
were
like you're
Rubio.
Saying, in a way, Trump's more dominant than ever, but it's his to lose. Because paradoxically, you also say MAGA's in trouble, which I agree. He's defeated the system on the right wing. He's got control, but now he can sink the ship because he's the captain if he runs into an iceberg.
Exactly. Yeah. Very well said. Yeah. He's slipping. He's losing the initiative. And, you know, and it's an unforced error. Like I said, if we cede economic populism to the left, we're going to open up a door for them to come back. And it'll be hard for the right wing to recover if this administration's a complete disaster. Because a lot of people voted Republican for the first time in 24. A lot of people came over because of the pandemic, because of the Ukraine war, all that
and
kind
Rasmussen
of stuff.
Has found they're now swinging Mondami.
Exactly. So if we blow it this time, we're really going to blow it. You know, the voter registration in Pennsylvania is now going left for the first time in years.
Yeah, Trump needs to act like a rebel and an underdog that he is, not the emperor in a gold gilded cage.
Yeah, he's got to take his prize. I don't get it. Like, we won. We won the election. We won after the persecution. He got shot in the head. Take your prize. Do
By
what
By the way, I predicted that he would not involved with Epstein and sex, but do it for Israel and MI6. And now it's come out in the emails they release. He worked for the Rothschilds, MI6, Mossad. That's always been known, but now it's confirmed. Trump literally wasn't involved with sex and Epstein, but he connected himself now. What a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. He like, why shouldn't he have just released all the files to begin with? Now we get the worst of both worlds. Because all this stuff is coming out about him anyway, and it doesn't look like it's actionable. Doesn't look like he was on the island or anything like that. But, you know, like you said, now he's associated with it. So
God, it's just advisors that just briefly, Venezuela, since you were on a few weeks ago, what's your view on it now?
I think we should take a deal with Maduro, honestly. I think that, you know, and who knows what's going to happen at this point. I think it's inevitable there's going to be military action, and Rubio wants to roll up the whole Caribbean. He wants Venezuela to go, then Cuba, then Nicaragua. And if he could pull that off, I mean, it's good. If he could pull that off, that would be an achievement. I mean, we would look back on that and say, wow, like, we reoriented the Western Hemisphere.
But they could launch a new Vietnam.
Yeah, that's the issue, is it's never that simple, is it? It always sounds tantalizing, like, oh, we're going to take over Iraq and then the whole Middle East will be a democracy. But it never really goes that way, does it? So, you know, Venezuela's not Panama. And we've been trying to take out Maduro for a decade. We've been trying to take out Cuba for half of a century. I don't know that that's all going to come to fruition. So at this point, it's unavoidable. I think we're on a collision course.
Yeah, when do you think Trump starts bombing Venezuela?
I think it'll be within the next couple months, maybe sooner than that. I think that Trump is going to try to give diplomacy a chance. He called Maduro, and Maduro has a choice to make here. Doesn't have a lot of cards to play. So it really comes down to whether Maduro is going to go quietly. But if he doesn't, then I think the bombs are going to start going anytime now within the next couple months.
Absolutely. I want to jam in a few calls here. People find you at Nick J. Fuentes on Rumble. But man, I'm a little jealous. I never had the Democrats try to pass a law against me. But you know, a sanction in Congress by the Senate, I never heard any 26-year-old having that happen, Nick. I know you're not on a power trip, it's how you're able to control it, but you ever like wake up and go, wow, is this real? Like, you know.
It's just kind of ridiculous. I'm like I do a talk show, I do a live stream, and it's like we're passing a resolution in the Senate condemning this live streamer. I'm like, don't you have other stuff to do?
Well,
like,
don't they know? Well, I mean, I actually wish Schumer would please give. I mean, God, Hillary came out and called me the dark heart. We got like 10 million viewers extra the next day. Like, well, don't they understand the Streisand effect?
Yeah, and even a lot of the pro-Israel people said, what are you doing? You're just giving it more attention. You got to stop this. And it's like, yeah, it's great for ratings. But I'm like, it just seems kind of ridiculous.
Remember,
like,
there's multiple videos of him serving raw hamburgers.
Oh, who, Schumer?
Yeah, he goes, here. He goes, I've never had a backyard, but my daughter's wife has a backyard. Here's your hamburger. And it's a raw red patty with unmelted cheese he's putting on a bun. So, I mean, maybe he is like a Martian. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't know how to. I mean, you haven't seen this?
No, I've never seen that one.
Serving raw hamburgers.
Ugh. Oh, man. Yeah.
And there's video of him serving them.
They're trying to role play as Americans. That's what happens.
Well, I mean, how do you not know how to cook a damn hamburger?
They never done it before. Plus, that's not kosher. Cheese on a burger, that's not kosher. Maybe that's why. He's got it messed up there.
Oh, my God. I can't believe this anymore. Oh, my God. We're in so much trouble. I mean, it just makes my head spin. Charles in Oregon, you're there with Nick Fuentes. Go ahead, Charles.
Good morning, awesome. Nick Fuentes, great show on the Sam Hyde Show. Shout out to the producers at InfoWars. Yeah, I've been on the hold for about 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. This is MK Ultra. Love it. Ultra Life Force. Bovine colostrum and the methylene blue. Make sure you do a quick AI search and it's not stuff to be messed with. Check with your health physician, check YouTube before mixing it with anything else.
Yeah, folks, we're not selling BS. That's a good point. Your question or comment, go ahead.
So I'm just really frustrated with all the infighting. I think Jones is spot on. We need to pull together and at least meet halfway. We need to all meet halfway. I love Candace. I love Laura Loomer. Nick Fuentes, I just got turned on to him. He's awesome. I loved him on that Sam Hyde show. Mark Dice, MTG, all these big names. I wish we could just meet halfway because I know the establishment loves the fact that this infighting is going on. I understand the issues with the Israel.
Yeah, but
and
see,
all
we're
that,
not doing infighting. You're bringing it up. But it gets ratings, so people do it. You know, I've had Laura Loomer trying to drag me into her stuff lately, and I'm just like, and you got MTG, you know, who's a really nice lady, Trump attacking her. That was so stupid. But, yeah, thanks for the call. What about the infighting, Nick?
Yeah, I think that wherever possible, we should try to unite. And at the minimum, we should all talk and engage with each other. But the problem is there are people on the right that want to cancel. And that's the difference. It's like you and I have had our disagreements and we agree on a lot and we talk about it and we're civil and we're polite and we're pointed in the same direction and we're always better off after the conversation. And that's true with a lot of people. But then you got these other people on the right like Levin and they're like, no, you can't talk to this guy. They tried to cancel Tucker. They canceled Kevin Roberts for defending Tucker for having me on the show. It's like the degrees of separation are crazy. So
now he wants Levin, like I said in an article, he wants college kids basically thrown out of their college group or banned because they dared watch the Tucker interview with me. Like,
yeah, college kids went to a dinner with the guy that talked to Nick in a show and didn't push back. Like, what are we doing with that? So I think that the Big Ten needs to be big. And I've never had any problem tolerating people that I disagree with. They always try to cancel me. And I know it's the same with you. You talk to everybody and anybody. So do I. It's the other side that says, no, don't watch InfoWars. Don't watch Fuentes. That you can't talk to these guys. They're the real problem. So I, in some sense, I'm in agreement. I don't like the infighting, but
we've got to differentiate. Joe. They're trying to ban ADF. They've killed 30 of their people in the last few months. Alternative Deutschland Party, or is it ADF? Or they? Talking about Germany, so that would be the Alternative Deutschland Party. Go ahead, Joe, in Florida.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Alex. This is at Joe Bender from Florida on X. The AFD, I've been concerned about this for a while and been meaning to talk to you about it. The Alternative for Deutschland is the party.
Yeah, they just put it wrong on the screen. I figured that was what it was. AFD, go ahead.
Right on. Well, I heard about it first on Fox Radio one day when I was driving, and they said, Elon Musk is supporting this far-right party. So I thought, well, what does that mean? You know, they've called MAGA far-right, not so much Fox saying that, but then they call Nazis, on the other hand, far-right when they're actually socialist. So I wanted to see what it was. So I went on their website directly to the source, and they have this thing called the Manifesto for Germany. And on page 5 of their Manifesto for Germany, they say they like social market economics and direct democracy.
Yeah, I mean, AFD is pretty libertarian. So what's your question or comment?
Well, my point is that I want to make is that I think that they're kind of getting grouped in with conservatives when they say they like social market economics, which is basically a planned economy, and that's not conservative at all. And then they say they want direct democracy. I don't know what the answer is for Germany or what the solution is, but and I don't want anything bad to happen to their members. Like they, you're mentioning that violence had been targeted. They've been targeted by violence, but I just think people need to be careful about who they.
All right, I hear you. What about Europe in general, and what do you think of AFD, Nick Fuentes?
Well, AFD has been drifting a little bit to the left, and you're right. There's a very strong libertarian faction, which is why I'm a little confused about the question. But they've been drifting very libertarian and very, in some ways, pro-Israel. But overall, I think the priority in Germany is get the migrants out, get rid of the hate speech laws. It's basically like the German state has no identity. They have their raison d'etre. The reason for their country, they say, is to like affirm the Holocaust in Israel. It's insane.
So what's your prediction for Europe? Is it salvageable?
I don't know. Europe is really spiritually very dead. The whole continent has apostatized. They're not Christian, and there's no energy. They're not having kids. They don't take pride. I will say there's a lot of positive signs, though. Italy has a right-wing party. AFD is surging. They're now the highest polling party in Germany. In France, you got the national rally coming back. Macron has a 13% approval rating. So politically, I'm a little bit optimistic, but they got a lot of problems, man. And they're throwing people in jail for being right wing. So it could go either way. It's very difficult to say right now. But things seem to be going pretty well over there. Seems to be a big right wing populist revival, maybe more potent than it has been in the past 10 years.
We only got a few minutes left. What are you doing in your show tonight?
It's been a little bit of a slow week, I got to be honest. I don't know if you feel that way, but not too much happening. I'll probably cover Venezuela tonight, and I might cover the statement on Somalia by Trump. Do a little of the stuff we did here on the show today. I'll recap it. But it's been a little slow past few weeks. Can't lie.
I don't know. You guys say a slow news day. My goodness, there is so much to cover, but I overall hear what you're saying. Looking at the midterms coming up, who knows what's going to happen, but historically the party out of power wins. 2028, that's just right around the corner. We're just like 2 years away from that starting up or less. Who else do you see other than Vance, who obviously is the main guy they're going to push with Rubio as his VP? Who would you support as a Republican?
Right now, I can't see anybody that I like. When people talk about Thomas Massie, I don't think he's running, and I don't know that I even would. I think he's too pro-immigration, to be honest. I know he's good about some issues, And people talked about Marjorie. I really did like her statement that she put out the other day attacking Republican men and telling them, make your own dinner. I really didn't like that. So there's not a whole lot. I mean, our options looks like Vance, Rubio, DeSantis, Kristi Noem, you know, maybe some governor somewhere. I'm really looking forward for a dark horse. I'm looking for somebody that maybe we're not aware of, maybe someone that's not on our radar, but I'm looking for like a young guy who's going to be far right, who's going to kind of tap into the Trump style and the Trump messaging from 16. But of course, with the topical stuff from this decade, I'm looking for somebody like that to come around, maybe that we haven't heard of. In the same way that when Trump came around in 15, nobody anticipated that he would dominate the race like he did. I'm looking for a figure like that, and I don't know if one will arrive.
Well, you can't run for president for 9 years, but are you going to run for president?
I don't know. Everyone's always asking me that. I don't think I'm cut out for politics. I'm not disciplined enough.
We're going to have the Jones-Fuentes ticket.
I would run. Hey, you run as president. I'll be your vice president. How's that?
Oh, my gosh. That's going to be quite the headline. So in closing, as we say, gut level, your prognosis for the West and the world, do we have a nuclear war in the next few years? Do we have a global depression? I mean, just big picture, how are you feeling about humanity right now? Because, look, the fact that, you know, nobody knew about the globalists 30 years ago, now a lot of people do. Nobody knew about America first, now they do. I mean, I've seen us gaining so much traction. We're not there yet, but we're moving so quickly. I'm positive overall.
I'm positive, too. That being said, I'm positive long-term, but short-term, I think we're headed for a cataclysm. It's unavoidable. I think between the AI-induced job losses, the debt bomb that we're sitting on, the emerging World War III, Taiwan in 27 maybe, the political disorder, I think in the short term, we're headed for a lot of problems. But I think that that kind of situation tends to create a rebirth. And so if I were to kind of map it out, I would say long term we win, but I think we're going to undergo a lot of tumult and trial and difficulty in the very short term, because just no getting around it. There's a true revolution going on in the world in every domain, and that always brings with it instability and disruption.
I mean, it's the fourth turn. It's great waiting. So in closing, what do you think it's like for the left and the ADL and all the control groups that had us under a spell, not you and I, but other people, total spell political correctness. When they said jump, we say how high. And now the more they intimidate, they see it all dissipating. What must it be like in their minds to see their intimidation, their bullying, their mind control ended? And then how do they respond to that?
Well, they're so defeated. I love watching these podcasts that they do, because they all still do. They all got a Substack. They all got pot. All these like journalists on the far right beat that would cover us, they all have a Substack, and they are just defeated. They do a small podcast for 1,000 viewers, and they infinitely complain about the stuff we're saying, the things, you know, the dynamics of the right wing. And so it's very delicious, because for, as you know, for years, these people were on us, and the bullying, they relished in the power they held to censor, to ruin lives. And they were like tattletales. They were like that character in Recess. They had like their little notepad they were going to run to the principal. Oh, Nick Fuentes said he's a white nationalist. Uh-oh, guess you lost your Twitter. And now they got nothing. So I'm very pleased with it. But at the same time, we can't make the mistake that they did. We can't have hubris. We can't get too carried away. We got to stay dialed in.
No, I agree. And we don't want to censor them because no one's listening to them. Try to just stop attacking late night comics for no viewers. We're not called for censors. We've won the intellectual debate. So we don't need to censor them. Plus, we don't want to. Let's be clear.
I do think we should punish them, though. I think they should be punished economically. They should be made non-viable, because if they got power back, they would use it against us with a vengeance. And so that's why, like when Charlie Kirk died, everybody said, no, we have to support free speech. I disagree. I support free speech in the law, but just like they did to us, I loved it when people were calling employers and getting people fired, people making death threats, should have been getting arrested. When we have the power, we have to use it against their shock troops and make their businesses economically non-viable. These like newspapers are being shut down. I love it. I love seeing Vice go out of business. I love seeing BuzzFeed News go out of business. We need to replicate that. And people should not be shy about that. It's not like we're going to give them a right to play in the game. If they win the game, they're going to kill us and our kids. They're going to trans our kids, and they're going to murder our ancestors.
They've given us no quarter, so they don't get quarter. Nick J. Fuentes on X and Rumble. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Another great interview. All right, we're out of time.